This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The 5.9 magnitude earthquake that struck Sabah on June 5th killed at least 18 people, but it also uncovered the Karazan Dusun's deeply held cultural beliefs following the incident of the stripping tourists. To find out why so many Sabahans were offended, we talked to Edin Koo, the founder of Pusaka, a Malaysian organisation that supports the performing arts of traditional communities. Also with us over the phone is Felix Tongkol, a geologist with University of Malaysia, who will tell us if this quake was unusual and if more tremors in Malaysia are likely. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Felix, perhaps we'll start with you. Was the 5.9 magnitude quake expected?
Yes, it was, actually. The reason for that is that based on our monitoring of earthquake activities in this region, we've already experienced like two, not as big as this one, but quite significant in terms of some of the damage done. The first one was in 1966, I think I remember, and then it was followed in 1991. So there was a previous earthquake before that. Of course, almost every year, there are small little tremors in Ranau. So it is something that actually is expected, yeah. But not as huge as this one was.
Since Sabah is not known to be earthquake-prone, what happened here? What led this to be to have such an effect?
Because of this accumulated stress or pressure in the earth due to some, you know, ongoing plate movement. This is the way, some plates are colliding and creating all this stress. And part of this is being released once in a while, periodically, along some of this fault line. And it happened that some of this so-called active fault line passed through Ranau. And actually, that's how it's possible to happen, yeah.
Does Sabah sit on a seismologically active area?
Yes, it is relatively considered to be the most seismologically active area in the whole of Malaysia, yeah.
So since we knew that this was something that could happen, why did it still take so many people by surprise? Did we know that it could happen, but we didn't know when?
Yes, that's the problem. We don't know when it's going to happen because we actually don't know how to actually determine exactly when an earthquake will strike. We'll have some indication of it, and we'll have some form of, like, for example, a cycle of it, like stress being accumulated, release, and then again, after that, accumulated stress will be released periodically. That one, I think, is some proven scientific kind of explanation of this. But exactly when and how big, that is still a mystery.
And how does the Met Center track quakes or potential earthquakes?
Oh yes, they have several stations. For example, in Sabah itself, they have 7 meteorological stations whereby they actually monitor all these earthquakes happening throughout Sabah. Of course, the whole country has several of these. Of course, they're doing this on a daily basis. I mean, they're looking at it. But of course, as I said again, based on all this reading, we cannot actually tell exactly when the next one will happen. Yeah.
Mount Kinabalu is thought to be a young mountain. Does this increase the likelihood of quakes or it being affected by quakes?
Yes. Definitely, it's a young mountain, meaning that it was formed about several million years ago. It's considered young in geological terms. If you talk about millions, it's quite long for us. But geologically speaking, the mountain is quite young. And so, if you notice, you still have hot spring right at the foot of the mountain, meaning that there's some heat being stored underneath Mount Kinabalu that is providing this source of heat for, you know, heating up the water, rainwater coming down and coming back again, yeah.
Before we turn to you, Edin, I was wondering, Felix, if you could give us a little bit of a sense of how people are feeling in Sabah with regard to everything that's happened, not just the earthquakes, but the public outrage that has occurred over the stripping.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in Kampung Nulu, just near the mountain. This is the nearest village near the mountain. They're definitely traumatized. They are, equally shocked, and they don't know what's happening next. So I was there, and I was trying to calm their nerves. I'm telling them that, the worst has already passed, but they, look at me with some, disbelief, and they hope that what I'm saying is true. And, of course, outside in KK that I noticed, people are still asking the same question. Why is it that you are not warned about this thing? And I think people are, you know, slightly angry, slightly, you know, people are a little bit upset with the whole situation that they are not forewarned. I think, as I said earlier, you can't actually forewarn all this, you know, earthquake being happening. But otherwise, I think things are under control, I would say, yeah.
Adin, Mount Kinabalu is also known as Akinabalu, or Revered Place of the Dead in Kadazan Dusun. Can you tell us how the name came about?
Well, there are two names. There's Akinabalu, Revered Place of the Dead. Then there's Kinabalu, the Weeping Chinese Princess. These are based, of course, on creation myths of the Kadazan Dusun, which are highly sophisticated and very metaphorical. Legends and myths around here, as you well know, have deep resonance with the cultural beliefs of communities, including in the peninsula, Malaysia. And when something traumatic like this happens, there is, of course, a very natural tendency for people to be contemplative and self-reflective of you know, things that have been passed down generationally. The controversies surrounding these issues, I think I said earlier, have also resulted from a combination of daftness on both sides. I think it's very irresponsible for people in positions of power to fall back on these myths to try and explain what has happened, and then the controversy that arises from the nudists and what is nothing less than a neo-colonial kind of sensibility takes away from what myths and legends actually mean to communities and how they abide by them, and the symbolism and the sense of self that emerges from them. The myths are very rich in nature and they are very complex, and I don't want to go into deep particularities, but they also, of course, totemize a point of origin for the communities there, not just the Kadazan Dusun. You know, most communities in Sabah have some sort of mythical relationship with Mount Kinabalu. So it has a very deep resonance in shaping the identity and sense of self of the communities there.
There's been some talk of the spirit of Mount Kinabalu, or the spirits. Could you tell us a little bit about them? What are the beliefs that are tied up in that?
Well, they are protective, but also can be very angry spirits, as is very common with most communities who possess that kind of metaphorical view of the world. There's a myth of King Gayanikon, who was believed to be, you know, this huge king who couldn't stop eating. He ate voraciously, and eventually, to save his people, he actually asked them to bury him up there in the mountain. But he promised, one of his pledges to them was that he won't always look after them. There would be periods when there would be famine and drought and lots of rage emanating from them. It comes, of course, from a very Southeast Asian concept of having balance constantly. As we know, in Southeast Asia, and this is also particular to communities in Sabah, everything is in balance. You know, good and evil must be in balance, light and shadow must be in balance, and nature must constantly be in balance, which includes an idea that sometimes nature will react very aggressively when there are occasions for it to be angered or something like that. So it's very much consistent with a Southeast Asian belief of this idea of constantly having a sense of balance in life and life of community.
And is the stripping in particular, you know, what makes it so deeply offensive? Because I think we can all agree that it was certainly, at the very least, a highly disrespectful act. But why in particular in this place to these people was it so offensive?
Well, I think it's not offensive directly to the people, especially since, you know, some of their leaders immediately took it up as an issue to kind of explain what had happened with the earthquake. So that immediately would resonate with the people. But I think it's not just Sabahans who are kind of outraged. I think most people with any sense of civility and decorum would be outraged. It's not just the nudity. I think it's also the manner in which these people conducted themselves. When they were warned not to do it, I think they used profanities at the guide, and then eventually there's, you know, one especially vulgar individual who's consistently mocking and lampooning beliefs and so on. Tourism is so much a part of the whole neo-colonial enterprise, you know, and I think one of the things that's very instructive to us is, I don't know why sometimes we run around these people, because They are incredibly offensive. And nudity aside, I don't see why they need to go into East India Company mode when they're told not to do something. Also, I think the outrage is, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, is also rooted in the sense of, where is the sense of supremacy of them coming from? Yeah, so I think it's very offensive to everybody else. And, you know, keep your clothes on, man. You know,
it isn't that difficult.
Yes.
Felix, from your end, then, how have you felt about the nudity and the stripping being tied up in terms of how the earthquake is being communicated to people in Sabah?
Yeah, I think it's very, very unfortunate that people, especially some of these leaders, immediately took the opportunity to blame someone, a scapegoat for this earthquake. As I said earlier, earthquakes are natural phenomena. They happen when they happen. And as I said, they happen when stress are being released. And if you tend to blame people for natural phenomena like this, I think it's a little bit overboard. Because, I mean, you can actually ask this. Same people who blame this to this new this as to what happened in 1991. There was an earthquake day, considered quite huge also, because there's a lot of destruction in Ranau town. But none of this thing happened. So, it's a little bit unfortunate that the coincidence was very close, and then it happened. And I think it's just a frustration from people. But I don't think they really meant it that way. Yeah. And of course, personally, I'm also disgusted with all these people who did those things, because it's really, really uncivilized for them to actually do that in a place that is highly respected. And personally, I think, what they did was wrong. Yeah, but that's not in any way connected to the earthquake itself. Yeah.
I'm speaking today with Edin Khoo, founder of Pusaka, as well as over the phone, Felix Tongkol, geologist at University of Malaysia Sabah. And we're getting two perspectives on the Sabah earthquake. Coming up, we find out a little bit more about the kind of rituals that are continued to be tied to the mountain to this day, as well as the likelihood of the earthquake happening again. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, you're listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today in the studio is Edin Khoo, founder of Pusaka. Over the phone, Felix Tongkol, geologist at University of Malaysia Sabah. The gentlemen are here with me because we are examining some different perspectives on what caused the Sabah earthquake, basically the science of it as well as the belief system that's informed the ongoing narrative. Edin, you talked earlier about how Mount Kinabalu continues to be tied in many ways to the people of Sabah. Are rituals still tied to the mountain, or, you know, practices still part of that?
Rituals are being performed more and more rarely. There are all kinds of reasons for that. You know, there's religious revivalism in Sabah too, especially among evangelical Christian groups who start to forego the rituals of their pre-Christian days. There's also, of course, modernity, which is creeping in, so people believe continue to practice rituals less and less. The rituals that are actually performed, and I think one was recently performed on Sunday, are very much rituals that are committed for appeasement, and appeasement not just of the spirits that are believed, but appeasement of the people as well, who have been traumatized or, you know, have had a sense of a community shock. So that is being done. And what it often entails is basically the invocation of memory through incantation, chanting and so on, sacrifice, so on. And a lot of these, of course, rituals are done with the objective of reminding ourselves to be humble, humble in the face of the might and the breadth and magnitude of nature. How much the symbolism is still remembered among communities is a matter of a question. But essentially, this is basically why it is done. And I think one was done several days ago, but it has not been done for a very long time. This was to appease the spirits of the Kinabalu Mountain, yeah.
And when you make reference to neocolonialism and how it's understood when you visit places, I suppose, such as Mount Kinabalu, do you find that there continues to be an imbalance or a misunderstanding of what's considered sacred? Because I think there is a certain level of, well, it's a mountain, therefore I'm allowed to do this.
Yes, I mean, there's that sense. But there's also the sense that, you see, we are not blameless in all of this. One of the things we do with our myths and our legends is we make them products to lure people of this kind to visit our places and to look at the exotic nature of our ways of life. That's when myths and legends become commodified. We are very much in danger of that. On the other hand, we've had very little in terms of real interrogation and real study of what our myths and legends mean symbolically, metaphorically. What is the place of metaphor in our lives as communities? And I said, you know, we are wading through cultural politics in both ends of Malaysia. And we are beginning to reject many of these myths as being not just things that are not compatible with modernity, but as alien to what we choose to be today in religious life, in cultural life, and so on. So I think all of a sudden, to be very conveniently invoking all of these things to explain a major natural phenomenon is to me it's just very telling of where our essential services and administration lies.
There's been some discussion about the native court system, which local leaders say the tourists should be tried in. You mentioned also the ceremony to appease the spirit of the mountain. What do you think it would take for there to be a sort of healing process or a sort of sense of justice to emerge from this?
Well, I think 10 buffaloes was what was asked for. Native courts, of course, are very much recognized in the formation of Malaysia treaty. I think what it really in the end provides is a sense that the beliefs of a people must be respected. It's not an issue of 10 buffaloes. It's about an acknowledgement that this consists of our belief systems, and you cannot vulgarize it in the ways that you are doing. So I think that would be very important for community reassurance. Having said that, as a culture person, I must say that a lot of this controversy has to do with essentially our inability to deal with phenomenon of this kind. Sabah has just happened recently. Kelantan happened at the end of last year, and we also saw the total inability of our administrators and politicians to respond to conditions like this. And instead, in Kelantan, for example, it was the rains came because we didn't implement hudud. So I think we really have to make our leaders accountable and look at essential services and listen to scientists such as Felix on a consistent basis, rather than fall back on something so convenient as our sense of identity and our myth and whatever not, which is very, very opportunistic.
Felix, what is the feeling in Sabah over putting the tourists in jail or getting justice from them?
Well, people think that they deserve it, of course. But of course, I think it's blown out of proportion, I guess. Yeah, for me, I think what the tourists did was disrespectful, and they should have been dealt with immediately, and that's it. And the reason why now people are actually wanting more than that is because I think they're just frustrated. And as I said, they always want to fall back into something that it's like a blaming game kind of a thing. But I think that's not the way to go about it. Yeah, and I totally agree that, this country of ours is not really that prepared for eventuality like this. Yeah, so there's always the tendency to blame something rather than to actually act on it quickly and sort it out and be professional about it and, deal with it as fast as you can. Yeah.
Are we actually equipped right now to deal with an earthquake should another one come?
I doubt it. Yeah, because we are not actually that prepared. Even our existing instrumentation in terms of measuring all these earthquakes, for example, are not sufficient. For example, even the mountain, there's so many tourists coming up there. We don't even have a sensor up there. I mean, a sensor is some form of a geophone, an instrument that we put there so that we know when those movement is occurring up there. We don't even have that. And even our stations are very limited. As I said, in Sabah, we only have 7. We only have 1 in Ranau. and of course one in Kota Kinabalu itself. We need more to be able to actually pinpoint locations, more precise readings and all those kind of things. We're still lacking in those terms. That is in terms of technology. In terms of human resource, I don't think that we have enough people who actually are able to actually give feedbacks timely and correctly. Now we are actually seeing lots of, overnight expertise coming out through WhatsApp, saying that, for example, 2 days ago, people were saying that, there's an earthquake happening at 11 something, and everybody was scared. And that was something that should never happen, because it's something that scares people. It's not a joke. It's not funny. People think that it's funny, but the people in Iran now, it's not funny to them. They couldn't sleep at night. And that is something that people have to be reminded. Yeah.
That fear is also coming from a place of people wondering whether or not this can happen again. So, Felix, you know, I have to ask, is there a chance of this happening again sometime soon?
A big one like this? Yes, but not as soon as I said. Earthquakes happen when you have accumulated stress and they have been released. I hope. What has been released last Friday would have been the biggest one. And so what we hope is that there'll be small ones coming in. It will be going on several more days as the mountain stabilize itself or the regions may stabilize itself. But it will take some time for enough accumulated stress or energy again to be stored to be released in the future. And this will take several years to happen. But I'm talking about Ranau, Mount Kinabalu itself. Earthquakes of similar magnitude would happen, but in a different area in Sabah, because Sabah is quite huge. And so a lot of fault lines actually passing through Sabah, not only in Mount Kinabalu, but other areas like Ladatu, Tawau, Kunak area. Those would be also very earthquake-prone area. And this could happen there. So in Sabah itself, similar kind of magnitude would be quite possible in the near future. Maybe. I mean, it's actually, if I want to, express myself here, in Lahadatu, the big one is already overdue. And so it's going to happen soon in Lahadatu. For example, the Ranau side is already passed, I think. So that's something that I think something good news for at least Ranau. Yeah.
So looking then at somewhere like Lahadatu, how much of it is prepared right now structurally to deal with an earthquake?
Well, most of the buildings there are actually not really earthquake-proof. Only one building there has been earthquake-proof, but that is experimental. And this is the building by the Malaysian Palm Oil Board there. But the rest of the buildings are not really earthquake-proof. And during the 1976 earthquake, most of these buildings actually cracked. And some of these cracks can be seen up to today in some of these old buildings, like the building from this Bomba, you can still see the building there, it's cracked. And those was due to the 1976 earthquake. And so I think that if something big, for example, magnitude 6, strikes Lahadatu in the near future, it will cause a lot of, damage.
Would you suggest then that at least as far as Sabah goes, that buildings be built with earthquakes potentially in mind?
Yes, especially specific areas. We're not going to build everywhere, but we have already identified that areas prone to earthquakes should take extra precaution when they, start building. Of course, all this old building, you cannot do much about it, lah. But new buildings coming up should take this into consideration to ensure that, at least a magnitude 6 kind of shaking should be taken into account, especially tall buildings, heavy buildings, and especially if it's like hospital or schools or those, buildings that are used by the public. I don't think it's really necessary for small houses, wooden houses to be able to add more to what is already available. Because during earthquake, most of these houses, as I see, for example, Ranau recently, most of the houses are quite intact. The wooden houses are all right, but it's the concrete houses that actually suffered most. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier people, sort of spreading misinformation and fear. Part of that is people over here in Peninsula Malaysia worrying that an earthquake would strike here. What's your take on that?
Yes, they were mentioned about KL being hit by an earthquake. Yeah. The possibility of KL being hit by a very small magnitude earthquake is there. Because the reason for that is that Kuala Lumpur itself also have some of these faults. They may be dormant faults, but it seems that after the 2004 huge earthquake near Sumatra, you know, Aceh side, most of these faults in Kuala Lumpur, near Kuala Lumpur itself, for example, in Bukit Tinggi, appeared to have been reactivated. And you have small earthquakes, day 3, magnitude about 3 plus that. And this is quite worrying because we've never had that before that. And now that we had that several years ago, now there's some thinking that it's possible that some of these old faults might have been reactivated and it's possible to generate small magnitude earthquake right at the Kuala Lumpur, you know, metropolitan itself. So, but this is just a possibility.
Felix, do you find that potentially the narrative of Malaysia being an earthquake-free country that we've been told all these years is a potentially harmful one now that we know that that's not necessarily the case?
Yeah. I think so. We should, you know, revise a little bit of that. It's not really as bad as Indonesia, Philippines, or the Japan, like that. We should be, you know, aware that we are actually somehow moderately affected by earthquake, but not the whole country. This is very important also. It should be site-specific, certain areas only, so that we don't scare people that, you know, there's earthquake everywhere.
And finally, my question to both of you then, how has the situation brought out gaps in understanding between Malaysians on the peninsula and those living in East Malaysia, and what can we do to bridge that gap in terms of how the earthquake's been communicated and how people have reacted to the beliefs of their fellow Malaysians?
There's a great deal of empathy. And I think one of the main things here is people want answers. And let's not drag our life of metaphors and symbols and so on, which are very important to community life and understand the shaping of our cultures and so on, into something that requires very pragmatic and practical answers. I'm very troubled by the attitude of some people who feel that our essential services cannot be questioned. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. Are we prepared? Are we not prepared? This is the second time. This follows on from Kelantan. Yeah? Kelantan was also a major disaster, and we saw the debacle, really, and people are still living under tents, and we still have no answers. In fact, the people who are expected to provide those answers, you know, provided with gobbledygook. That's something that really needs to be challenged. And I think a very basic understanding that you are accountable when things like this happen has to be acknowledged, I think.
Felix, what do you want to communicate to people scientifically about the earthquake?
Yeah, I think first thing, people must understand that earthquakes are natural phenomenon. It's something that is created by some, you know, things that we do. When it strikes, there's nothing much you can do about that earthquake happening, yeah? And that's the first thing. The second thing is to understand that earthquake actually just create all this shaking, but it doesn't really harm you in that way. What harms us is structures, buildings that we are living, or staying beside hilly mountains where you have landslides and all those kind of things. Those are the ones that we worry. And so we must ensure that, you know, we site ourselves properly. For example, avoid all these areas, if possible, of course. And then when earthquakes happen, do not panic, because it's not something that is going to happen for long. It will be just for a while and it will pass. Yeah, but of course, this is something that I think people have to be reminded again and again. It's easy to say, but of course, once you are traumatized by it, I know it's difficult to convince people to not panic. But yes, that's the most important thing. Understanding how earthquake happens would be a very good start for people to be able to control themselves. Yeah.
Thank you both very much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Edin Koo, founder of Pusaka, as well as Felix Tongkol, geologist at University of Malaysia Sabah. And we've been gaining perspective on the Sabah earthquake that happened recently. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.